Support for this episode of the podcast comes from our patrons at Patreon. Go to patreon.com/chasingearhart to join the chase and become a patron today. On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 81 years later, all over the world lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to Season 2 of the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
She didn't like the fame, but she accepted it because it was what she had to do if she was going to accomplish what she wanted to do, which was to inspire women to get off their duffs and do what they wanted to do, you know?
She'll be the first girl to do it, to fly around the world, so don't forget who flew it, have that bunting unfurled. When Amelia Earhart circles the globe and comes flying home again.
It does not take courage so much to go as it does interest in the task. I believe that women have as much courage as men.
Okay, so where do you start with this guest? If there was a shining example of someone that would be sort of the embodiment of Amelia Earhart's legacy and what she wanted all those years ago, I believe that my guest tonight would be it. And joining me via Zoom is Emily Calandrelli, and most of the time when we have a project guest sit on the show, they're either an author or they're a scientist or a speaker or an astronaut or something like that. Emily, though, is something else entirely, and we're going to get in touch on all of that, I promise. But this is an absolute honor. Emily, welcome to Chasing Earhart.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So we have so much to get to tonight, but as always, let's get some housekeeping out of the way. Now, Chasing Earhart has about 240 guests from all over the world now, but you have one of the coolest backgrounds probably ever. So let's talk about it. Can you tell everyone listening a little about your education and your professional background?
At, you know, bird's eye view, I'm a MIT engineer turned science TV show host. But to dive more into that, my educational background, I have 2 undergrad degrees in mechanical and aerospace engineering and 2 master's degrees from MIT in aeronautics and astronautics and also in technology and policy. So studied a lot of science and engineering for a while, and then kind of, it was a right time, right place situation. My executive producer today, he was looking for a host of a new space show and was scouring the web for someone with expertise in the field and who had experience talking about this sort of stuff to kids and to adults in a way that's maybe entertaining and understandable. And he had found videos of me doing this throughout my educational career and picked me as the host, and I've been doing stuff like that ever since.
Now, the next question I ask is something I ask of everyone to sort of establish like a foundation, and now I think it's your turn to answer this question. Do you have any early recollections of Amelia Earhart growing up?
A little bit. I mean, it's funny because I obviously know the name, but I feel like she's having a resurgence as of late with just a lot of more information that's coming out about her, and it's kind of following the trajectory of a lot of other female hidden figures throughout history who maybe didn't quite get their due during their time and have now been given a platform to showcase their stories. So we're learning more about the people from the movie Hidden Figures and people like Amelia Earhart and even women like Ada Lovelace. And so, yeah, I think now I'm learning more about her, and I've heard just very high level stories about her when I was young, but nothing too in depth that I remember.
You know, I, in writing this interview, I struggled sort of exactly with where to kind of start this interview, because there's so many jumping off points we could tackle. But I think what we should start doing is just go broad spectrum and kind of work our way in. So I want to ask you right off the bat about STEM. We've talked about this before a lot on our show, and this time I want to come at this a little bit differently though, because the work you've done sort of regarding pushing STEM is really groundbreaking. And so I want to start by simply asking where we are. Can you give us a snapshot of the current state of STEM when it comes to young women?
When it comes to young women? Yeah, I think that across many fields in STEM, there's a few exceptions, things like biology and some parts of chemistry and a lot of the types of science where there's this inherent idea that you can help people with it. I think that those parts of STEM, they don't see as large of a discrepancy in gender representation. But in most parts of STEM, we see a discrepancy in their representation of genders. Obviously, most of them are male-dominated fields. And so, you know, you kind of have to start historically with this story because in the beginning, women, weren't expected to work. And if they were expected to work, the jobs open to them were things like teachers, nurses, and secretaries. Nurses leading into the medical field, which is why a lot of those medical type sciences have more females represented there. But today, we're working from a very hard start. So that kind of gives you a picture of as to why there's not that many women in the sciences today, because before, we weren't really invited. So we're kind of working from a very tough position there. And today, it's a very nuanced problem with just the idea that it's an all-boys club. Joining engineering or science is seen as a very hard major if you're going into college. And on top of that very difficult decision, wanting to do a hard major, you also have to make the conscious decision to join what's seen as an all-boys club, which may not seem very fun for a high school senior to do. But then beyond that, there's a lot of bias that people of power hold when they're hiring, when they're promoting. That kind of stifles the climbing the ladder of many women. And then harassment and all of that. So it's a very nuanced issue. There's not really one silver bullet. And of course, it starts when we're young because there's not a lot of representation of females in science that we can look up to. As we mentioned before, just now are we seeing these wonderful stories of the Hidden Figures today. We didn't have them when I was young. And so we didn't have a lot of female STEM role models to look up to. So yeah, it's a pretty diverse issue with no one great solution, but I think now it's being recognized and there's a lot of people that are trying to address it. So I'm hopeful for the future.
You know, it's interesting. My dad always told me that when you look at someone that's successful on their life path, you generally want to ask them two questions. What do you do and how do you do it? And you have really spent your career sort of creating new ways to approach the idea of getting more women inspired in STEM fields, especially young women. Your talks are very unique. Your books, which we'll get into shortly, are fresh. They're exciting. And your interactions on sort of a more intimate level with people leave like a real lasting impression for some of the stuff that we've done when we look at research on you specifically. When you started this journey, what did you want to accomplish and how did you want to tackle it? Did you have any idea?
Well, no, I feel in many ways I'm learning as I go and finding new opportunities to do things differently, because when I started out, I kind of didn't really know what I was doing, and I'm just sort of infusing what I know and my background into this career that I found myself in, which is a science communicator. And my background really influences the way that I do that. So I'm from West Virginia. West Virginia is a wonderful, beautiful place, and I'm very thankful that I grew up there. It's also a place where it has the highest percentage of people who don't believe global warming is happening. And so I think knowing that there are very kind, wonderful, hardworking people who deny science, that influenced the way that I talk about science in my career, because I know that it's not for lack of education. It's a very, you know, difficult challenge. It's a nuanced issue. There's many, 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 many reasons why different people deny science. And so because of my background and knowing that, and knowing that there's really wonderful people who deny science for various reasons, I approach the way that I talk about science differently. And you have to be really strategic about the way that you talk about science, because facts do not convince people, even though we wish they would. Humans are very tribal. Humans have pride. Humans are very self-interested. And so we have to talk about science in a way that speaks to people's values, in a way that speaks to people's interests. All too often, we like to talk about things that we care about rather than listening to what the people that we're trying to reach, what they care about. And so you have to bait the hook to suit the fish. And that is true for marketing. People in marketing have been doing that for years and following that mantra for years. And so we need to start doing that with science as well. We're not immune to wanting people to speak to our values when it comes to science.
You know, there's something that I've been wanting to ask you since you came into our radar. And it's a very simple and direct question, but I don't think it's one we've ever asked anyone on the show. And it's, the question is, how important is imagination in children?
I'm a Disney girl. I am obsessed with Disney. I grew up going to Disney every couple years. I took a semester off to work at Disney. And I say that because I think that speaks to my interest in sparking imagination. I think it's like a very, to spark imagination in either children or adults, you have to be very strategic about it. It's a skill set that I admire very much. And I think Disney is an arena where that has happened for a long time. And it's a mix of storytelling, a mix of magic, a mix of attention to detail, and all of that stuff combined can change the impression of a kid for a ride or a kid for a theme park experience. But you can also infuse that into TV shows and books and other things. Anytime you're trying to make a lasting impression, sparking the imagination of a kid or an adult is important.
And you know, that's a good segue into something that I've been excited to talk to you about. And my son is actually reading these right now, but can you introduce our audience to Ada Lace?
Yeah. So Ada Lace is a children's book series that came out a little over a year ago. And there are now 5 books total in the series. 4 books have come out so far. The 5th book comes out this February. And Ada Lace is a 3rd grader who loves science and technology and builds robots and gadgets to solve mysteries in her life. And I made the series because I wanted to create a book that I wish that I had when I was a kid. A book about science and adventure that had female leads. Because I didn't feel like I had a lot of that when I was a kid. And speaking, going back to one of the issues with women in STEM, we don't have a lot of representation growing up. And women, especially girls, start to lose interest at a very young age in science for a number of reasons, but one of which I think is that we simply don't have female role models in STEM. And so Ada Lace is my contribution to that world, to hopefully bring a female STEM role model to little kids, both boys and girls.
You know, and these books are aimed at children. We've talked about this a little bit, but I read somewhere online that a while back that most children start to kind of form what will become their life dream starting at around 6 years old. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the importance for children to have characters like Ada to really inspire them to start dreaming, like if they haven't already, and maybe especially when it comes to STEM, like you just touched on it a little bit, but let's get into that a little more deeper because I think that's really crucial.
Yeah, because it's one thing to have role models that are older who have already accomplished the most wonderful things in life. I mean, those are going to have to be older adults. But then it's another thing that I feel like it makes it a bit more relatable when there's a kid pursuing those dreams that you may want to do as an adult. So Ada builds robots and gadgets and things that are probably a bit advanced for someone who is in 3rd grade. But it shows what a scientist or an engineer can do. Because Ada is close to their age, close to the age of the child who will be reading this book, I think that it certainly helps to make that experience more relatable, that science more relatable. At the back of each of the books, I have a behind the science section. It's basically like a glossary for the science that's in the book. Because during the series, what I like to create is something called accidental learning, where the kids, they don't realize that they're learning because they are so engaged in the story and the mystery and the adventure that Ada is in that they don't realize that they're learning about science along the way. They're accidentally learning about all of these cool things. And so for any kid that wants to dive in more to those specific science topics, there's a behind the science section in the back where I touch on usually between 5 and 10 science topics that we mentioned in the book where I provide examples of reasons why I wanted to include it and opportunities to learn more, resources to learn more outside of the book. For example, there's one story where Ada is coding, learning some early coding skills. And I mentioned that Scratch is this MIT platform online where kids can learn the basics of what coding means and learn how to do a little bit of coding themselves. And it's meant for that age range of 6 and up. And so yeah, I think Ada makes science more relatable. I think the fact that she's a girl makes it impactful to both boys and girls to see women and girls in a different light when it comes to STEM. And yeah, it's just a fun story that they can get caught up in and like the character who's going on these adventures.
And now you're doing book signings and little ones are coming up to you dressed as Ada, which is really cool. That must be super cool for you to have made this creation. And then you see like the cosplay and all the stuff that's like the inspiration must be really great.
Yeah, it's really heartwarming to see that, especially when I go back to West Virginia, because the Ada is from West Virginia in the book. And that was done intentionally because West Virginians don't often have a lot of great stories about West Virginians to look up to. The stories and anecdotes that people tell about West Virginia are not often kind. The stuff you see in the news and in the media, and West Virginia as a state has a lot of problems, and the news obviously wants to highlight different problems in the world. And so because of that, we often hear not great stories about West Virginia all the time. And so I wanted to create Ada as this West Virginia girl who is an intelligent girl and goes on all these adventures. And so anyways, when I go back to West Virginia to do these book signings, one story in particular, I had this parent come up to me and say, my daughter was reading her book and she was in the living room and I was in the bedroom, and she got to the part of the book where she found out that Ada was from West Virginia. And she ran into my bedroom and said, "Mom, oh my gosh, Ada is from West Virginia. Did you know that? She's just like me." And that story was like, okay, that is exactly why I wanted to make her from West Virginia, because this little West Virginia girl like now has this deep connection to this character who is smart and intelligent and creative and makes all of these wonderful friends and works together to solve problems. And it just has this role model that she can feel a little bit closer to.
Yeah, it's important to relate. It's important to get your reader to relate directly to something, to connect to something specifically in the book. And sometimes it's a nuance, sometimes it's something that somebody does or a behavior. But yeah, the fact that they're just from the same state that they're from or the same city that they're from, it can be a big connection, I think. That's pretty
exciting. Yeah, it absolutely can. I think we've realized that very intensely when it comes to like sporting events and stuff. If somebody shares the same sports team as us, we feel like we have some connection to them. It's an easy conversation point. And so as an author, you can't forget that when you're writing these books, because even though it's just a small thing, we don't really mention West Virginia too much throughout the book, other than to say that Ada comes from West Virginia, her family comes from West Virginia. That little thing makes this book means so much more to every kid in West Virginia who picks it up.
I want to ask you, was Ada, did you base Ada on yourself a little bit? Like, did you have a scientific mind when you were little at that age? Do you remember thinking about science and thinking about different things that maybe a lot of other girls maybe didn't think about?
Yeah, well, I didn't actually. I based Ada off of the kid that I wished that I was when I was younger, because Ada seems to, we write her in a way, Tamsin and I, the co-author, we write her in a way that she has no fear when it comes to trying things. She may not always do it right. She fails a lot, which is normal and expected. But I, as a child, and even sometimes today, I struggle with trying things for fear of failing. And so Ada is the bravery that I wish that I had, the just try it type of attitude that I wish that I had when I was a kid. I didn't have anyone in my family who knew much about science or engineering, no one who pursued a career in any of those fields. I didn't have anyone in my extended family. I didn't know anyone who was in STEM. And so I wasn't really introduced to a lot of these concepts, a lot of this type of kind of tinkering around until I was in college. So yeah, Ada was somebody that I wish that I was when I was little.
And you know, we've talked a lot about role models in this show and then in this particular episode with you. But you know, as I poured over Amelia's career, when we started this project, I can't tell you how many times, and you just touched on it a little bit as well, we've been on set or we've been at an event and we've had little girls come up in full-blown cosplay as Amelia Earhart to our team. And I feel like young women, young girls especially, seem to be sort of starving for people to look up to in their respective fields or in whatever they want to do and with their lives. And now you're sort of in the thick of all this. And I remember reading a quote Sally Ride had once said, that you can't be what you can't see. And, you know, like I said, you're in the thick of this now. You become a role model. So many young women who look at you and they see sort of a hope. They see hope for what they want to do with their lives. And I wonder if you can give us your personal thoughts on sort of that level of responsibility. Does that weigh on you? Is it something you take into consideration on all the projects that you take on and what you do and when you talk?
It's definitely something I take into consideration. It is funny because I obviously am a huge advocate for women in STEM because I am a woman in STEM and I think there should be more of us. But my platform is really just science. I try to get everybody excited about science. And it's natural for people to, you know, mention that I'm a role model for women because that certainly makes sense. I think that the activities that I do probably speak more loudly to women. But it is kind of funny because in every conversation I have with anyone, that's the first thing they mention is that I am inspiring girls and it's a great thing. And it is. But in my head, I'm sort of like, but I'm inspiring boys too, I think. It's a funny job. I talk to other women in STEM about this and we kind of joke that you can't have any conversation or any interview or whatever without someone mostly pointing out that you are inspirational to women. And that's great. And we love that. But at the same time, we're sort of like, well, we got into this because we love science. We want to inspire everyone to get excited about science. So it's just sort of like a funny topic. But of course, we are glad that we are a role model for little girls because we need more women in STEM. And representation is so important. One thing I try to do when I go and talk to teachers or educators or whatever, is I introduce them to other diverse people in the science communication world, especially YouTubers. There's a lot of diverse YouTubers out there who have not just gender representation, but different personalities and obviously people of different races and people who have different types of humor, people who are sarcastic, people who are outgoing, people who are more reserved. Finding someone who looks like you is great. Finding someone who feels like you means even more. And so when as a teacher or as an educator or as a parent, if you can introduce your kids to this diverse range of people, all of a sudden their concept of what it means to like science becomes so much more complex, which is beautiful, right? Because we don't want to have this kind of caricature of what it means to be a scientist. We want to have this diverse idea of what it means to like science, because I think our community, our society needs to believe that everybody can understand science and technology. You don't necessarily need to be a scientist or an engineer, because the world that we're living in today is becoming more and more reliant on technology and science. Everything that we do in terms of how we live our lives, how we make sure that we're healthy, how we make sure our families are being healthy, the types of products that we buy, the policies that affect us, and anything from climate change related policies, but also net neutrality and genetically modified foods and the FDA and all of these things that can sound very confusing. We need our citizens to feel more comfortable thinking about science critically and thinking about technology critically. So yeah, I think one step to doing that is to introduce kids and adults even to a wide range of science communicators who are all very, very different.
Yeah, YouTube has been huge for that. It's my son watches a lot of science stuff on YouTube and just a lot of science channels and a lot of he wants to see kids doing science because I think that's my wife homeschools him and because we travel a lot for the project and he's seeing kids like his age that are doing science and like you mentioned different races, religions, different sex, it doesn't matter. Like it's just we want science to just be science and not be, well, it's science for women or science for boys. It's like, no, it's just science. That's it. It never should be compartmentalized like that. And that's why, but he loves it. He loves YouTube. I think YouTube's been huge for children.
It really has. It's really impressive. My friends that do YouTube, I'm constantly, admiring the work that they do because that is just next level creativity, next level type of innovation when you're trying to inspire, talking about inspiring imagination. I mean, the people who are doing their work on YouTube, I am in awe of. They do incredible work and certainly getting a lot of kids excited about science.
You know, it's funny, as you were talking earlier, I was thinking about, we had an experience with Dr. Anita Sengupta formerly at JPL, but she was giving a talk in Santa Monica. This is probably 9 or 10 months ago. And we were in the audience just watching the talk. And she showed this, you know, she showed this photo when they were testing for the supersonic parachute for the Curiosity rover. They're out in the desert and they were testing. And she took this photo, or someone from her group took this photo, and it's like her and like 25 dudes. And that's it. It was like, there's no other women in the photo. And she's talking about like, we're making progress on medical. We're making progress on all these, you know, in law, but we have like, we're starving for people, for women in science. And she's, you know, she was talking about a lot of that. And it kind of echoes what you were talking about as far as just inspiring young women. Cause there's so many young, I looked around in that audience and there was packed house. And there was just a lot of young girls, like 12 and under, in that audience. And it was just great. It was just so cool to see them like ask. And they were talking about all these different things afterwards and asking her all these complex questions at like 12 and 13 years old. And it was just such a phenomenal thing. I was just so in awe of that. And
it's awesome.
It really needs to continue. I think it's a revolution that needs to continue. Now, I want to give a little exposition for everybody before I ask you this next question, before I tell you about this. This has to do with Amelia Earhart, I want to get just your personal thoughts on kind of this idea. Back in 1934, on September 26th and 27th, Purdue President Edward Elliott at the time heard Amelia Earhart speak at a luncheon in New York on women's careers. And he was so impressed with her talk that he asked if she would visit Purdue and talk to the women there. And she spoke at a banquet at Purdue on October 17th and 34. And the title of the talk was Activities for Women After College. This was the title of her talk. And she had several talks with President Elliott after that. And make a long story short, from autumn of 35 until she disappeared in 37, she was a consultant in the Department for the Study of Careers for Women at Purdue. She was a technical advisor in the Department of Aeronautics for Purdue. And I first learned about this probably a decade ago. And we just had Sammy Morris, who is the head of archivists at Purdue, on. And Sammy had kind of dropped a bombshell on me during mid-conversation. She said that Amelia was tinkering with like a women's lab at Purdue when she disappeared. And they wanted to have like engines on display where women could just come in there, almost like a full-blown shop for women to tinker and kind of let their creative juices flow and everything. And I wonder, this is in 1934. And I'm wondering, did this woman just have a vision that was like 100 years ahead of anybody else at the time? Like, did she pioneer an early STEM revolution before STEM was even a thing? Like, I wonder about that. And I wonder if you could like maybe just give your thoughts on what I just mentioned and just kind of talk to me about like how important that was at that time. Because this is 1930s. This is early when women had, they just went to school to get a degree and that was that, you know, and this woman came along and she was like a rock star to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots of thoughts. I think probably any woman who had a career like hers would want to create something like that. I mean, basically, she probably found that she was someone who liked science and engineering and thought it was kind of ridiculous that women weren't generally given the opportunity to do so. I would say that there were probably not a lot of people in power that were willing to give other women lab space to help other women. To think that she was ahead of her time, I think that probably any woman who was studying science and engineering could be thought of as being ahead of their time. But in reality, they were just the lucky ones who didn't get discouraged or pushed back or their career wasn't stolen from them. So yeah, I think that the person who gave her the lab space, that person was probably very rare in that time, because I'm sure any woman who loved their career in science and engineering would have loved to do something similar and probably simply wasn't given the chance. So I have to imagine it's not a brainchild of Amelia Earhart that women would want to tinker with engines and enjoy science and engineering. I have to imagine other women in the field would have loved to do the same thing, but simply weren't given the platform to do so. But I think that it's wonderful to hear that somebody was trying to push the boundaries back then. It's kind of ridiculous that it has taken so long to have that idea come to fruition today. Nice to hear that was happening back in the 30s.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. It's one of those things I just kind of, you know, it's always been fascinating for me. And what I want to ask you, and we've talked a lot about STEM in this conversation, of course, but I want to ask you, because people will hear, speaking of women with platform and people with platform, obviously you have a really great platform yourself. And I want to know, people might listen to something like this or one of your talks and say, well, that's great, but what can I personally do to help with this? Or what can I personally do to have an impact? And I wonder if you can maybe talk. So let's answer that question. Like, what can we do as a society, or just, you know, as an individual, even if you want to get involved, if you want to make a difference, if you want to make an impact for both young men and women? I mean, what can we do to help?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who's pursuing a science and engineering career needs support. And so if you can be supportive, that can be one of the most powerful things that someone can do if you can help find resources for that someone. I mean, engineering and science degrees are challenging and time consuming. And a lot of times, you know, certain people may not have time to pursue that type of career. Time is it comes as a privilege to many. I was lucky enough that I went to undergrad at West Virginia University and I had earned a scholarship that meant that my tuition was paid for. So I didn't need to get a part-time job that stole 20 hours a week away from my studies. I could use those 20 hours a week or more, some people work even more than that, to focus on engineering. And I really needed that time because I was a bit of a slow learner. So I couldn't afford to get a part-time job. So I was very privileged in the fact that I didn't have to pick one of those part-time jobs. But, you know, some people don't have that benefit. And so trying to be supportive in any way that you can, whether it be helping people study, helping people find opportunities to pay for things. I think when it comes to supporting women in aerospace or women in science in general, speaking up when you hear misogynistic jokes or misogynistic things happening, even when you feel like it's not your place, it happens all the time. It happened during undergrad and graduate school for me. Nothing too serious, but, you know, side comments that were a little bit annoying, and those little annoying comments build up over time. And for a lot of women, it forces them to leave the situation because they don't want to have to deal with these kind of, I call them like micro sexist comments, because individually, if you look at them, they're not that bad. And if you ever pointed one specific thing out, you would sound silly in saying that bothered you, because you could just wave it off as one bad apple in the bunch. But they build up over time. And so if men particularly can stick up for women when those things happen, that would very much help. Recognizing bias. Everyone has bias. No one is perfect. I have bias. It's good to recognize the bias that you have and understand how that impacts your decision-making, whether it be who you choose to be on your team, who you choose to be on a panel, when you are building a conference, making sure that you don't have panels that are just completely all men, panels that are completely all white, really working to try to add diversity and women to panels is extremely important, because oftentimes when young people are first entering the industry, that's their first taste of what it means to be a professional in the world, in their career. And they see these panels and those are supposed to be the experts in their field. And so showing diversity on those panels not only is good because it highlights to younger people what they can do, but it also adds different perspectives to whatever conversation you're trying to have. So it makes the panel better as well. But yeah, and biases in hiring and promoting as well. So speaking up, understanding biases, and then when you are in the power, if you have the power of choosing who gets to do what on panels at conferences or speaking or hiring or whatever it is, understanding your biases and trying to overcome them to create a more diverse environment can be very helpful.
Emily, I just have one final question before we wrap up today, or tonight, I should say. We just crossed the 81st anniversary of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan's disappearance. And I wonder if you can, just strictly for you personally, can you tell me what someone like Amelia Earhart means to you personally? Like when you hear the name, like Amelia Earhart, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think of a woman who was an explorer, an adventurer, who took risks, and someone who was doing so in a time where it may not have been attractive or easy to do something like that as a woman. And so I kind of see somebody who doesn't really care what the status quo is and is doing whatever the hell she wants anyways.
Can you share your, I know you have a website. Can you share your website and your social media with us, please?
Yes. So I am on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Space Gal. And I am found on the interwebs at thespacegal.com.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I've been excited to have you on the show ever since we first talked a couple months ago, and you didn't disappoint. It's been a genuine pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chasing Earhart podcast, part of our Legacy Retrospective series. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Come back to ChasingEarhart.com each week for another new podcast. While at ChasingEarhart.com, visit our archives and our blog to hear all of our past episodes and interviews with guests such as Brad Meltzer, Tom Vinson, Candace Fleming, Jessica Cox, Abigail Harrison, and Shasta Ways. You can also hear interviews with representatives of all of the relevant hypotheses regarding the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, such as Tom King, Dick Spink, Gary LaPook, Rick Gillespie, Andy Sherrill, and more. Also at our site, you can find hundreds more posts, project updates, and much more information regarding the life and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a show without any sponsors or ads. We rely on support from listeners like you to keep the Chasing Earhart project operating. You can donate to the show, and as our thank you, receive bonus podcasts, merchandise, and advanced opportunities for Chasing Earhart events. Find a full list of available shows and rewards at patreon.com/chasingearhart. You can also follow the project on social media, where our team posts all of our shows, news, and project information. And that hashtag is @ChasingEarhart. The Chasing Earhart podcast is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Tom Myers. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmidt, and narration is done by Forrest Burgess. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated. Chris Evan Films, Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education, and no infringement is intended. The Chasing Earhart podcast is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated, and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films, Incorporated. All rights reserved. The Chasing Earhart podcast is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2018. All rights reserved.